Thanks, Alessia, and thanks for the invitation. It's always a pleasure to be at PI, whether in reality or in virtual form. Alessia asked me to talk about this recent paper, Constraints on Discrete Global Symmetries in Quantum Gravity, co-authored with Passant Ali, Martin Pauli, and Michael Scherer. And I'm happy to do that, and I will put that a little bit into the broader context of the discussion of the interplay of matter and quantum gravity with a focus on symmetries. And then specifically, I'll talk about this specific discrete global symmetries, because they also have sort of interesting phenomenological applications related to the natural generation of mass hierarchies. And I'm very happy to be interrupted with questions at any point during the talk. So if I don't see the raised hands, I'm sure Alessia will let me know that there is a question. So symmetries sort of shape nature and also our quantum field theoretic description of nature across different scales. So if we start at sort of mesoscales in condensed matter, then various materials are described by the various global symmetries that the degrees of freedom have, and in particular by the spontaneous breaking of these various symmetries. This is what determines various phases of matter. Then if we move to more microscopic scales, to particle physics scales, then it's again symmetries that shape these quantum field theories. In the case of the standard model of particle physics, it's mostly local, so gauge symmetries. There's also one global symmetry. And again, the spontaneous breaking of symmetries responsible for the mass generation mechanism in the standard model is, of course, really at the heart of the theory. Then we know that the standard model isn't complete. There are presumably some dark sectors responsible, for instance, for the dark matter content of the universe. And we don't yet understand what these sectors are, but the theories that we write down for those mostly are also shaped by the various local and, in this case, also global symmetries that these various models have. And then as we zoom in even further, we encounter the Planck scale, where quantum gravitational degrees of freedom are expected to become important. And this is the scale where there's just a big question mark, and we don't understand what actually happens to these various local and global symmetries, what their fate are, whether they can sort of persist under the impact of quantum gravity. So as we sort of zoom in further and further, then at some point we encounter these riddles. But of course, nature does not work in this way that it sort of zooms in further and further. This is just how our understanding advances. Nature works in the exact opposite way, namely that what happens at microscopic scales shapes what happens at macro scales. And so therefore, all of these symmetries at these scales here, they somehow have to be embedded or even explained from what happens at the quantum gravity scale. And so in particular, one could hope that by understanding the interplay of quantum gravity and matter and the role of symmetries here, that one can then also answer questions like, well, why is it that the standard model has a particular set of symmetries that it has, which in some sense seems a little bit arbitrary? Why is it these symmetries and not others? And I see that Lee had a hand up.
Yes, I'm just making trouble. Are you sure it always goes only that way from the small to the large?
So I would say that would be the paradigm that I would follow here. But I mean, of course, that is an assumption, right? And we don't have sort of proof that that's a standard sort of standard paradigm in which we think, and that is the one that sort of to me makes logical sense. But I don't have a proof of that. But I also don't have a counterexample where sort of the macro scale would determine what happens at the micro scale.
Okay, I'll tell you one later.
All right. So then, continuing with this question here, why these symmetries and not others, I'll try to take a sort of very small step in that direction by asking a particular sub-question of that, namely the one where the symmetries in the standard model, those are continuous symmetries. So for instance, a U1 or SUN symmetries, those are not discrete symmetries where we have, for instance, rotations by discrete angles, so a symmetry group like a Zn symmetry. And so asking this question, what happens to discrete symmetries? Why are there none of these discrete symmetries here? Can one somehow explain this from quantum gravity? That's sort of a very, very small step in this direction of trying to shed some light on the symmetry structure in particle physics coming from a quantum gravitational perspective. So that's sort of the big picture motivation of this. And so before I then go into a discussion of that, I would like to sort of mention a word of warning in the discussion of symmetries in quantum gravity meta models. Because unlike what one sometimes reads in the literature, at the moment we can't really make universal statements about the fate of symmetries that really apply across quantum gravity approaches. That might be something that just describes the current state in the field. So it might very well be that at some point we will understand how the mathematically distinct frameworks of various approaches, how some of them fit together and give us a unified or a universal physical description. And that would then of course also allow us to make statements about symmetries in the interplay of quantum gravity with matter that hold across various approaches. But currently, I think we haven't reached that state yet. And to just drive that message home to show you one specific example, how different the statements of about symmetries in different quantum gravity approaches are, I would like to take a short detour to say something about chiral symmetry. So that will not be the focus of the latter part of the talk. I will just use this as an example here to show you that what different approaches to quantum gravity have to say about symmetries for matter, that really differs at the moment. So, first, a mini introduction to chiral symmetry. So chiral symmetries are symmetries that affect the left-handed and the right-handed components of fermions separately. So they rotate the left-handed into left-handed components and right-handed into right-handed ones. Such a chiral form of symmetry precludes the existence of mass terms for fermions. So whenever you write a mass term for fermions that mixes the left and the right-handed components, there's a sort of a very intuitive way of thinking about why that has to be the case. And that has to do with the fact that if you have a mass, then the corresponding degrees of freedom travel slower than the speed of light, which means that by a Lorentz boost, you can overtake them. And that flips a left-handed into a right-handed component because it flips the direction of travel of that degree of freedom. And so therefore, whenever you have a mass, you have to have this mixing of left and right-handed components. Now, in a quantum gravitational context, if quantum gravity has any impact on that mass, then purely based on dimensional analysis, you would expect that mass then becomes of the order of the Planck scale. And so therefore, under the impact of quantum gravity, you would expect that having fermions which are light becomes a bit of a challenge. And therefore, if you have such a chiral symmetry that protects fermions from just acquiring masses in this way, that's a way of ensuring in particular that they can remain light even under the impact of quantum gravity. So that's the reason why people are interested in chiral symmetry in various quantum gravity approaches. And now on this sort of red to green bar, I have sorted various approaches with respect to this question, whether or not chiral symmetry is something that is preserved in that particular approach to quantum gravity. So in string theory, as far as I'm aware, there aren't any specific works that ask that question, but there are stringy arguments that say that in general, global symmetries shouldn't exist, and that would also preclude any global chiral symmetry. So string theory would thereby sit somewhere in this sort of red region to say that chiral symmetry cannot be realized. The loop quantum gravity is an interesting example because there are arguments based on the Nielsen-Nyomiya theorem, which is a theorem that says that chiral symmetry cannot be realized in lattice-like settings. So based on the theorem, there is an argument that says that chiral symmetry should be broken in loop quantum gravity, but there is also work that says that there are ways to circumvent the theorem. And so I've put loop quantum gravity somewhere in the sort of orange region here, where I would say that the question probably deserves further work to be fully settled. Then Euclidean dynamical triangulations is an example where this question has been looked at more recently. And there are some indications that once you tune to a continuum limit, there could be sort of a precursor of chiral symmetry that then becomes chiral symmetry in that continuum limit. And you might therefore have light fermions in that setting. That is under this assumption that indeed you can take a well-defined universal continuum limit in EDTs. So I saw that Bianca had a hand up.
Bianca, you are muted.
The stringy arguments that say that you can have no global symmetries. But then there's also the issue that you could still understand global symmetries as local symmetries. And in fact, you should if you couple quantum gravity. So that could you see that also for chiral symmetry?
So I mean you can of course have settings where the sort of the chiral symmetry, the sort of the symmetry that transforms just the left on the right-handed components, that is actually a local symmetry, right? Like for instance, the standard model, the SU2 symmetry is one that specifically just transforms the left-handed components. And of course, if you have a local symmetry being a chiral symmetry, then that is also an argument to still have light fermions in that setting. So it's really just, so here is really just a statement, if you want your chiral symmetry to be a global symmetry, what would you say? So this is not the statement that in string theory fermions necessarily have to be as heavy as the Planck scale. All right, so then going through this this list of examples, there is also an example that is in this green region, and that is asymptotically safe gravity. And I don't really want to go through all of the details here. I'll just sort of give you a quick summary of the status there, where first of all, the statement is that quantum fluctuations of the metric don't lead to a breaking of that chiral symmetry. But there are then sort of two ways to sort of mechanisms that can lead to chiral symmetry breaking in that setting. First of all, through what is known as gravitational catalysis, which has to do with chiral symmetry breaking through a curved background. So not through the fluctuations of the geometry, but just through the fact that there is a non-trivial background geometry. And that is an effect that could kick in above a certain number of fermions, so that you couldn't accommodate more than a certain critical number of light fermions in the setting. And then recently, together with Gustavo Brito and Mark Schiffer, will actually be joining PI in the fall. We've looked at the interplay of gravity and abelian gauge fields, which can break chiral symmetry together with fermions. And that led us to find indications for a lower bound on the number of light fermions. And so here, asymptotically safe gravity would then be somewhere in this green region, at least for a certain range of fermion numbers. So I saw Lee had a question.
Yes, what about instanton effects?
So that's a good question that has actually been looked at in a first work that I didn't list here by Masatoshi Yamada and Jan Pawlowski last year. And they do find some indications that there could be instanton effects that do lead to chiral symmetry breaking in that setting.
Great, okay, yes. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for pointing that out. I forgot to include that work here.
Sorry, one more question.
Yeah.
Just want to make sure. So here the string theory is the only one that just doesn't allow any global symmetry, where the other ones allow a global symmetry at either high or intermediate energy scales, but it may or may not be spontaneously broken at lowest scales. Am I understanding correctly?
Yes. Yes, and I mean, with these examples, indeed, string theory would be the only one that just wouldn't have that global symmetry at all. And in the other settings, of course, as you sort of dynamically lower the scale, you can then in the infrared, where you have just the meta theory, you can have sort of the standard mechanisms of chiral symmetry breaking that come, for instance, in strongly coupled gauge theories, and so on. And of course, this is not an exhaustive list of quantum gravity approaches. So there's quite a few approaches where this question simply hasn't been considered yet.
Okay, thanks.
There is one more question by Lee. Lee, you have to unmute yourself.
My understanding is that with spatially compact boundary conditions in quantum general relativity, there's a theorem that says there are no global symmetries, which was proved by Karol Kukoc in the 1970s.
I would have to look at that. So you said that
that is also for only gravity, and they don't include matter.
That's for what gravity?
That's only gravity without matter.
Sure.
In any case, as I say, that if you have gravity, there might indeed not be any global symmetries, because you should look at the most local symmetries.
Sure.
Well, I don't think I would necessarily agree with that, right? I mean, you can just have global symmetries for your meta degrees of freedom as sort of, you know, just on some form of internal space. That doesn't, you don't need to necessarily make them local symmetries.
Just physically, that it might be unrealistic that you can imagine that you turn them all everywhere in the same way, you know, so that you still get the global symmetry as a limit from.
I don't think that this argument of sort of, you know, that you find maybe local symmetries more natural. I mean, you can argue that apart from a sort of quantum gravitational setting, you can just argue that in general, right? I mean, just on under purely sort of mathematical grounds, there isn't any problem with having a global sort of internal symmetry, and then having sort of, you know, sort of standard quantum gravity with local diffeomorphism invariants and so on.
Yeah, I'm just meaning that chiral symmetry is not excluded in a sense to emerge as a global symmetry from a local symmetry.
Yeah, no, sure.
By the theorems that say there can't exist any global symmetry.
Yes. So of course you could also just have settings where sort of any global symmetry of a meta theory is just an emergent low energy symmetry that sort of emerges in some sense accidentally. You don't necessarily have to have settings where you put them in at microscopic scales. But conversely, at least in some of these quantum gravity settings, there also isn't an argument that tells you that you cannot have such a symmetry put in at microscopic scales, and then it simply just survives all the way from microphysics to macrophysics.
Uh-huh.
So basically, the upshot of this slide really was just to give you a concrete example to show that I don't think one can currently make universal statements about symmetries in quantum gravity approaches, because the statements about chiral symmetry are just a very concrete example to show that currently in the different approaches that seems to have a different status. And this is just sort of as a word of warning, because sometimes statements about odd symmetries and their fate in quantum gravity are made sort of with a more sort of universal sounding way. And so for the rest of my talk, I will actually focus on asymptotically safe gravity here. And of course, I know that some of you are quite familiar with the approach, but others might not be. And so I'll try to give a lightning review of the asymptotic safety paradigm, and specifically those aspects which will be important then to talk about the discrete symmetries that I want to talk about later. So the asymptotic safety paradigm is a quantum field theoretic paradigm, and it allows us to address two challenges that quantum field theories of nature have. And the first challenge is that there can be a Landau pole problem in quantum field theories, which is just the problem that scale-dependent couplings exhibit a divergence. And the interpretation of that divergence is that signals the scale at which the theory breaks down, and you need to include further degrees of freedom, or you need to go beyond quantum field theory. And the second problem that quantum field theories of nature have is that those quantum field theories that we typically work with, for instance, the standard model, they are effective field theories, which actually feature all possible interaction terms that are compatible with the symmetries. And so therefore they are parameterized by infinitely many free parameters. Then at low enough energy scales, most of these infinitely many free parameters don't play a role. But as you go towards higher and higher energies, at some point, all of these free parameters become important, and then you're encountering a productivity problem. And asymptotic safety is nothing but quantum scale symmetry, and that's a potential solution to both of these challenges. So scale symmetry, of course, is just really this idea that as you zoom in, something looks the same no matter how far you zoom in. So you have a certain form of self-similarity. And quantum scale symmetry is the incarnation of this idea in a quantum field theory. And concretely, it means that if you look at the dimensionless versions of couplings, for instance, here, this is the dimensionless version of the gravitational coupling of the Newton coupling, that then the beta function of that vanishes. And that is what gives you scale symmetry. So specifically for gravity, for instance, it would mean that the dimensionless Newton coupling and also all other couplings feature a quantum scale invariant or asymptotically safe regime at high scales. And then there is a transition scale where you depart from that. Now, the key point about asymptotic safety is, first of all, if I just go back briefly, the Landau-Pohl problem that is sort of solved in that setting is probably intuitively obvious. If I just have constant couplings, then I can just zoom in as far as I want. I will never encounter any Landau-Pohl. So the onset of scale symmetry saves me from that. But how does it actually solve this predictivity problem? I would like to take a little bit of time to explain how the predictive power of asymptotic safety comes about, because that will be important later on to understand the fate of discrete symmetries. So if we look around us, then we clearly see distinct physical scales, which means that even if the microscopic description of nature features quantum scale symmetry, then at some point we have to break that symmetry and depart from the scale symmetric regime. And the departure from scale symmetry, that's actually only possible along so-called relevant directions. So those are directions in the space of couplings where quantum fluctuations act to drive the theory away from quantum scale symmetry. And this simple beta function here is a toy model for a relevant direction. The critical exponent that is associated to this fixed point here, which is just the negative derivative of the beta function, that quantity is positive. And that means that if you have a tiny perturbation away from scale symmetry, then quantum fluctuations will act to enhance that perturbation. And so this means that if you start with quantum scale symmetry in the UV, you can then reach a whole range of couplings in the infrared. And so therefore, such a relevant direction is not associated to a prediction, it's associated to a free parameter. And now conversely, if you have an irrelevant direction, where you can get a toy model for that by just flipping the sign in the beta function here, then the corresponding critical exponent becomes negative. And that means that quantum scale symmetry now acts as an attractor. So quantum fluctuations drive you towards quantum scale symmetry. And so in this simple toy model, you already see very clearly that scale symmetry in the UV then corresponds to a prediction of the value of the coupling in the infrared. So demanding scale symmetry in the UV, you don't have any freedom in the value of the coupling in the IR. Now in reality, of course, you don't just have these sort of simple settings with just one coupling. Typically there's a whole bunch, infinitely many couplings in the theory. And then there are some directions of a fixed point, which are the relevant ones. And then there will be many, which will be the irrelevant ones. And in this three-dimensional sketch here, you can see as a function of the value of the relevant couplings, which allow you to go away from this fixed point, but which keep you in this UV critical surface, as a function of these relevant couplings, you get a prediction for the value of the irrelevant coupling, because if you start with scale symmetry in the UV, you can only reach points in the infrared which lie within this critical surface. You can't depart anywhere from this purple surface. And so one way how you can think about these predictions from asymptotic safety is that in the far UV, you have quantum scale symmetry. It's sort of like the Cheshire cat being present. And then quantum scale symmetry is no longer present in the infrared, where you have departed from quantum scale symmetry, but a sort of a smile of the Cheshire cat remains behind, because as a consequence of UV scale symmetry, there are relations between couplings or predictions of coupling values that follow for the infrared. And this predictive power for infrared values of couplings coming from UV scale symmetry, that is what will be important later for discrete symmetries. Specifically, the framework in which I will talk about that here is the functional renormalization group, which is basically a way to do a path integral in a momentum shellwise fashion. So one introduces a regulator term that basically implements a mechanism such that as a function of a scale k, I can integrate out quantum fluctuations all the way from the UV into the infrared. The big advantage of the setup is that I can transform the functional integral into a functional differential equation, which encodes the scale dependence or how the effective dynamics, how that changes as a function of scale. And the way to use this, this flow equation is that it allows to do two things. It first of all allows to find the fixed points, the quantum scale symmetric regimes, by solving the equation where one demands that the scale dependence of the effective dynamics or of the couplings vanishes. And this then provides a starting point to then integrate out quantum fluctuations all the way from the scale symmetric point in the UV, integrate out all quantum fluctuations down to the infrared. And then the quantum scale symmetry in the UV will have specific consequences for values of the couplings in the infrared. And in gravity matter systems, this then looks as follows. So there are three regimes that we pass through as we integrate out quantum fluctuations scale by scale. I see there's a question by Hank.
So in the previous slide, in the action that you written now, the quantum action, so you have fermions, right? Because you're taking the super trace.
Yes, so this is sort of a very general setup. So this path integral that I wrote here is of course just a simple scalar field, but you can generalize that to any meta degrees of freedom. And in particular, you can include Grassmann valued fields. So this is the more general form. This is just sort of schematic for scalars. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So you should think of this as sort of generalized to all sorts of fields.
Because in the case of fermions, I've worked with, because this looks like a Bethe-Salpeter equation in condensed matter. I've worked with them before. And like what happens is like, because you're coupling fermions to gravity and you have like curved space-time in the background, but then in momentum space, what happens is that like if you have charge, if the, like if you dope your system, let's just say you dope your system and you have a charge imbalance between electrons and holes, then you get Fermi surface in the momentum space. But like has there been work where people study like Fermi surfaces in the curved setting?
That's a good question. So I mean, so this equation is applied quite broadly, also in condensed matter, in various systems where you specifically integrate out sort of particle hole fluctuations and things like that. Whether this has been applied to condensed matter settings on a curved background, yes, I think to some extent. I mean, in these questions of, for instance, gravitational catalysis, you would have a setting like that where you would look at fermionic systems on a sort of classical curved background. So I guess the answer would be yes.
Mm-hmm. Because
another example is where people study quantum anomalies, and then people have to consider coupling to background curved space-time.
Yeah.
So in general, there isn't a technical problem with that. If you go from a flat background to a curved background, what changes is that you no longer do this in sort of Fourier space, but you do this in this eigenvalues of whatever your appropriate Laplacian is, that belongs to the choice of background that you've put in. Mm-hmm. Does that answer the question?
Yeah, because it's mainly that instabilities occur on the Fermi surface, so you sort of get these I guess the RG fixed points that you're looking for near that region in momentum space or the Fourier space over there. But yeah, I was just wondering about that because that seems very interesting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I think that there are a number of works that sort of look at these condensed matter type settings on curved backgrounds. But of course, I mean, the majority of works in condensed matter settings is of course on a flat background.
Yeah, thank you.
All right. So then, in this case of gravity meta systems, we have three regimes that we pass through as we change that that scale k. There is first of all a fixed point regime of gravity together with meta, and here I've just chosen as an illustration a figure from this particular paper that looked at a bunch of standard model couplings. But this is really just as an example. Think of this as this just one example of the general idea that in these gravity meta systems, if there is asymptotic safety, then there is a fixed point regime. Then one can use the Newton coupling, which is a relevant direction of the fixed point, to trigger a departure from quantum scale symmetry. And one can choose where that transition scale is. That is basically the free parameter that belongs to this relevant direction. And one typically places that transition scale at the Planck scale. And then once one has left the scaling regime, the dimensionless version of the Newton coupling just falls off with the scale k squared here, which means that the dimensionless Newton coupling falls off very quickly. And that leads to a very quick dynamical decoupling of the gravitational fluctuations. And then for scales lower than that, gravitational fluctuations no longer play a role, and instead I'm just passing through a regime where I just integrate out quantum fluctuations of matter. So this is then a standard sort of particle physics matter regime. And in this setting, then of course, if some of the couplings in my matter theory correspond to irrelevant directions, then as a consequence of quantum scale symmetry in the UV, I would see particular imprints, namely predictions for the values of those couplings in the infrared. This general idea has been explored in a number of works here, and I apologize for everyone who's not on the slide. This is not a complete overview, but that gives you some idea of what the status of asymptotically safe gravity meta models are, and that constitutes the background on which I want to talk about the discrete symmetries. And so both sides of the interplay of gravity and matter have been explored. So the impact of matter degrees of freedom on a gravitational fixed point, and also the impact of quantum fluctuations of gravity on the matter side. And sort of as an upshot of all of these works, I would say there's reason to be sort of cautiously optimistic that standard model-like matter theories together with gravity could indeed be asymptotically safe and predictive. And I guess after yesterday's announcement of results, it's also opportune to point out that there are also various beyond standard model settings which have been explored. So there's a list here, but in particular, one which could give you the right value for the muon magnetic moment. So this is now the background on which I want to come back to this question of discrete symmetries. Specifically for scalar field theory. So I will focus very specifically on complex scalar field theories for the rest of the talk. And I first want to say something about these symmetries in effective field theories. So starting with the kinetic term for scalar fields, this kinetic term exhibits shift symmetry as well as a global U1 symmetry. And then one can write down a standard potential term, which still respects the U1 symmetry, but which has broken the shift symmetry. And then the discrete symmetry would be one which would allow this particular type of interaction term that no longer respects the standard or the full U1 rotational symmetry, but instead it only allows rotations by discrete angles. And so this then only realizes the Zn subgroup of the U1 symmetry. And so basically the question that I will be getting at is trying to understand whether or not the existence of such a symmetry and the existence of such interactions is something that is or is not compatible with asymptotically safe gravity. Before I do that, let me tell you a little bit about the phenomenology of such a term, because just from a purely effective field theory point of view, that's actually quite an interesting type of interaction. And for that, we have to take a brief look at the potential. So this is just the potential in the space spent by the two components of the scalar. At a positive mass, you just have the standard potential, which clearly exhibits a U1 symmetry. If you switch on one of those Zn terms, here, for instance, as a Z6 term as an example, you see that explicitly breaks the rotational symmetry down to this discrete symmetry. So the potential is then has these little indentations at in this case at these sort of six specific angles. Now, what happens if we break that symmetry spontaneously by just choosing a negative value for the mass squared? Then we have this Mexican head or sort of bottom of the wine bottle type potential. And then there is Goldstone's theorem that tells us that there is a mode that we call the transverse mode that has to be massless. And that is the mode that is related to excitations in this angular direction in the potential. So because the potential is completely flat in the bottom, that mode is massless because the mass is tied to the second derivative of the potential. And that changes if you turn on this explicit U1 symmetry breaking term, so such as the N symmetric term, that you can see generates curvature at the bottom of the potential. It generates sort of little dips in the potential here, and it thereby generates a transverse mass. And phenomenologically, that is actually quite interesting, because that actually allows you to generate mass hierarchies without the need for any extra fine-tuning. So let me go into a little bit of detail here to show you how that works. So if you just go to the symmetry broken regime, then it's useful to parameterize the potential in terms of a vacuum expectation value, kappa bar, which is a dimensionful quantity. And the longitudinal mass, so tied to these radial excitations here, that is then set by this vacuum expectation value times the quartic self-interaction. So that's the standard mass term for scalars that you would have, for instance, also in the Higgs. And then if you turn on this Zn symmetric interaction, then additionally, you also get a non-vanishing transverse mass that is determined by that Zn coupling. And then there has to be a particular power of the vacuum expectation value that follows from dimensional analysis. And now the interesting thing is, if we look at the dimensionless ratio of the transverse to the longitudinal mass, that is set essentially by that Zn symmetric coupling. And now that coupling is one which has a dimensional term in its beta function, which actually means that if you are in a regime where the coupling is small enough, so where you can forget about higher order terms, then that coupling just scales with a high power of the scale. And so this is just a plot that shows you what happens to that coupling. So the red line here is a Z6 coupling. And if you start with a coupling of order one at some UV scale, then this canonical scaling that coupling exhibits just drives the coupling to really tiny values pretty quickly, which is really just a reformulation of the statement that this is a coupling that is what we call a canonically irrelevant coupling. And because that coupling becomes so tiny under the RG flow, the dimensionless ratio of masses, which is set by that coupling, is actually also driven to really tiny values until you then enter the symmetry broken regime. So there is then one fine-tuning that is required in the system, namely the standard fine-tuning that you always have to do in scalar field theories if you want to separate the scale of the vacuum expectation value from your UV cutoff scale or sort of mass scale of new physics. So in order to separate these two scales, the UV cutoff scale and the scale of the vacuum expectation value, for that you have to do the standard fine-tuning. That then gives you a hierarchy between the longitudinal mass and the UV cutoff scale. But then once you have separated these two scales, then because the coupling Zn is automatically driven towards really, really tiny values, you don't need to do any second fine-tuning to get a tiny ratio of these two masses. So you get the second mass hierarchy completely for free. And this is just what makes these Zn symmetries sort of phenomenologically interesting, because they are a counterexample to this intuition that whenever you have a mass hierarchy, you have to fine-tune something in your system in order to get that. So they give you an automatic a mechanism where at the cost of one fine-tuning, you get two separate mass hierarchies. And so this is this is one of the motivations to explore symmetries like that and then try to understand whether this is something that could be compatible with a quantum gravity setting. So let me now ask the question, what happens to these various symmetries if I subject the scalar field theory to the impact of asymptotically safe quantum gravity? And there's a sort of a longer story based on understanding the interplay of these various symmetries that provide you with an argument, but that is also supported just by the explicit calculation, namely that the fixed point values for all of these interactions, for the mass, for the quartic coupling, and for these Zn couplings, the fixed point values of those turn out to be zero. But as I've told you previously, the fixed point values are sort of only half the story, because what we really want to know is whether, starting from these fixed point values, whether these couplings correspond to relevant directions so that we could generate finite values for those couplings in the infrared, or whether they correspond to irrelevant directions so that, as a consequence of asymptotic safety, these couplings would have to vanish in the infrared. And in order to determine that, we have to evaluate the critical exponent. And evaluating that critical exponent, there is a gravitational contribution that is the same for the critical exponent of the mass term, of the quartic interaction, and also for these Zn terms. And then these critical exponents differ from each other because they also have contributions from the canonical dimensionality. And so this Fs is a parameterization of the gravitational contribution that turns out to be smaller than zero, and that I'm showing you here for an example where it has been calculated in the Einstein-Hilbert truncation, where I have a Newton coupling and a cosmological constant. And here I'm not showing you the equation for the Fs simply because it's a lengthy expression. I'm just showing you a plot of it in this plane spanned by the two couplings in the Einstein-Hilbert truncation. And you can ignore these yellow and green contours in the background, just focus on the dashed contours. Those are the contours of the Fs. And you can see that it is negative everywhere in the space of these couplings, which actually means that, for instance, the quartic coupling, it always has a negative critical exponent, and the Zn coupling, it also always has a negative critical exponent. Whether the mass is relevant or irrelevant, that depends on whether the Fs is negative enough. So if the Fs is negative enough, that happens in this region up here, where I'm again showing you the G lambda plane, just a slightly different region of that than what I've zoomed in this plot here. So up here, all of the scalar couplings are irrelevant. Down here, the mass parameter remains relevant. What that actually implies is that in the fixed point regime, the the n coupling that I want to focus on now, that is irrelevant, which means that quantum fluctuations drive that coupling towards a vanishing value. Then at the Planck scale, quantum gravity fluctuations decouple dynamically and you lose this gravitational contribution to the critical exponent. And then we are left with just the canonical scaling, which is still towards irrelevance. And so therefore the Zn coupling simply has to stay zero at all scales. And what that means is that these calculations indicate that one cannot have any of these discrete Zn symmetries with n larger than 4 realized in asymptotically safe gravity matter models. And so therefore, here the answer would be that if we want to have asymptotic safety in the UV, we can say something about the symmetry, the allowed symmetry structures of matter models, namely that one cannot have such discrete global symmetries.
Sorry, did you say that the gravitational contribution to all three couplings are the same?
Yes, so in the vicinity of the free fixed point where these couplings vanish, there is sort of one universal gravitational contribution to those, for instance, here in the Einstein-Hilbert truncation.
Uh-huh. Is there any deep reason?
I don't think there's a deep reason. It sort of just follows from the structure of the renormalization group equations, in the sense that there's sort of a gravitational a contribution from gravitational fluctuations just to the sort of entire scalar potential.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, but I'm afraid I can't give you a sort of a more intuitive reason for that.
Thanks.
All right, so the upshot here would be that if you really demand asymptotic safety to be realized fundamentally, then that would tell you that you shouldn't be able to observe any such discrete symmetries, any such discrete global symmetries in matter theories, at least in scalar matter theories. But now, of course, you could ask, well, but do we really know that asymptotic safety would have to hold all the way up to sort of arbitrarily microscopic scales? Or could it be that there is some more fundamental theory? And what happens in such a setting? And so I'll just take 5 minutes or so to shed some light on that question. So that brings me to the more general idea of effective asymptotic safety, which uses the fact that fixed points which have more than one relevant direction can either be UV fixed points or infrared fixed points. So basically a fixed point that you start with as a UV fixed point for the trajectories in the critical surface, that fixed point is attractive starting from somewhere else in the space of couplings, and you can approach it as a sort of infrared or intermediate fixed point. And so here on the right, you just see one specific example where you have a set of two couplings, and you can see that this fixed point here is a mixed fixed point. It has infrared attractive and infrared repulsive directions. And so it can either be the end point of RG trajectories that come from here and end in this fixed point as an infrared fixed point, or it can be the UV fixed point for a trajectory that comes out of this fixed point and moves towards this one in the infrared. And so this is the idea that underlies this paradigm of effective asymptotic safety, where the idea is that there is some more fundamental gravity matter theory that doesn't even need to be a standard quantum field theory. And that holds above some scale MS, where you can think of S as being strings or spin foams or whatever your fundamental favorite gravity theory is. Then below that scale MS, you're in an effective quantum field theoretic description, and you can then approach an asymptotically safe fixed point as sort of an infrared fixed point where you're attracted towards that along its irrelevant directions, and you then have a range of scales over which sort of effective asymptotic safety is realized, and then you depart from the vicinity of that fixed point along one of its relevant directions. So that's sort of the general idea how asymptotic safety could be connected to other sort of more fundamental quantum gravity settings. And now one can ask, within this paradigm where asymptotic safety is just realized as an effective description, can I say something about these discrete symmetries there? And so in that setting, we don't really know. It depends on the more fundamental theory, of course, whether or not you could have finite values for such a Zn symmetric coupling. If yes, then you start with some possibility for finite values of these couplings at that new physics scale. And then quantum gravity fluctuations together with the canonical scaling drive that coupling Zn towards smaller values in this effective asymptotically safe regime. And then you hit the scale where gravity fluctuations decouple and you're left with the matter contribution. And that changes or enhances the story that I told you about the generation of mass hierarchies in such settings, because the mass hierarchy is generated essentially because that coupling Zn just runs towards tiny values very, very quickly. And the gravitational contribution to that is in the same direction. So what that actually means is that under the impact of quantum gravity fluctuations, these mass hierarchies get even larger than they would be without quantum gravity. And this is just a particular illustration of that, where we are comparing the dimensionless ratio of masses, this gamma, with and without the gravitational contribution. And this plot is basically telling you that the larger you make the gravitational contribution, the smaller the corresponding mass ratio becomes. And so therefore, if you are in a setting with effective asymptotic safety, so the setting where there is some more fundamental description beyond this new physics scale, if that more fundamental description allows you to have finite values for these couplings, then in such a setting, the resulting mass hierarchies in the infrared would even be enhanced compared to the setting without gravity. And so that actually already brings me to my summary slide. So I have sort of two key messages from this talk. One is that this work was motivated by this question whether one can make headway in understanding where some of the symmetries in particle physics come from by thinking about that from a quantum gravitational point of view. And here we've made sort of a very, very tiny step forward in that by understanding that discrete Zn symmetries in scalar sectors don't appear to be allowed if gravity is fundamentally asymptotically safe. And that is, of course, sort of one tiny step towards understanding why the standard model should actually exhibit continuous instead of discrete symmetries. And then the second part of the take-home message is that these discrete symmetries are just quite interesting from a purely phenomenological point of view, because they can allow you to generate mass hierarchies without the need for any fine-tuning. And under the impact of gravitational fluctuations, that effect is enhanced. Whether or not that is actually applicable to real-world phenomenology is an intriguing open question. It's something that you cannot straightforwardly export to the standard model, because this Zn symmetry that you need for the scalar that is incompatible with a scalar that is also charged under a gauge symmetry. But potentially such mechanisms might be applicable in sort of dark sectors beyond the standard model. So with that, I'd like to thank you for your attention, and I'm looking forward to further questions.
Thanks, Apelsfield, for a very interesting talk. Okay, so are there questions from students first? Hank?
Yeah. Thank you for the very interesting talk. Because it's related to condensed matter, I can sort of talk a little bit more. In the previous slide, like the first summary slide that you wrote, saying that there's no discrete Zn symmetries in, for example, standard model, isn't that only true? Because you're sort of forcing n larger than 4, right? Then
yeah. Sorry, I should have written n larger than 4 here. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yes.
But in that case, like for example, if you have fermions in the quantum gravity asymptotically safe regime, then you could have chirosymmetry, which is Z2. So that this doesn't
Yeah, sorry for being unspecific on the slide here. So this applies for n larger than 4, because I mean that 2 is of course a symmetry that you have sort of automatically realized as a subgroup of various sort of continuous symmetry groups. So basically most kinetic terms for meta fields automatically give you a Z2 reflection symmetry in that meta field. And of course, yes, for fermions, you can also have particular sort of simple forms of chiral symmetries. So this statement here more precisely should be no discrete Zn n larger than 4 symmetries for scalars.
Mm-hmm. I see. I guess for n equals 3, that's really interesting to
you. Yeah, n equals 3 is an interesting borderline case because there might be, so that might sort of circumvent this argument that I gave before, because in that case there is really a competition between the gravitational effect towards irrelevance and the fact that a Z3 coupling would be canonically relevant. So whether or not that is driven to zero, that actually really depends on sort of a balance of the gravitational effect and the canonical scaling.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so, okay. So specifically the symmetries that I was really interested in here are those with n larger than 4, because those are the ones that are connected to this mass hierarchy generation mechanism.
Right, right. Thank you.
Ding.
Hi, Astrid.
Hi, Ding.
My question is, did you consider real scalar field theory as well?
No, we focus on the complex scalars because, in that case, you can realize this higher sort of the 6 symmetry in the sort of complex scalar field plane, right?
Okay, so do you have any intuition what to expect if you consider, say, a real scale? Because, I don't know, maybe it is relevant to the dark sector, as you mentioned. And in that case, there's something different, I guess. You can have a non-trivial Z2 symmetry with a Φ3 term.
So for a real scalar, I can build something like a Z2 symmetry, but I mean, to build these higher order Zn symmetries, I need something like a complex scalar to sort of realize these discrete angles of the symmetry.
Mm-hmm.
So you need at least two scalar degrees of freedom, sort of the real and the imaginary component, to build these symmetries in a non-trivial way.
Okay.
Okay, so now there is an anonymous question. If there cannot be global symmetries in a theory, but there can be local symmetries, can't we get a global symmetry by setting the local symmetry to be constant across space-time?
Yes, but I mean, of course, if you have a local continuous symmetry, you would typically, I mean, you would have gauge fields associated to that, right? So if you really just want the pure global symmetry, then you have to somehow decouple your gauge fields in that setting. But of course, I mean, if you have a local symmetry, you always have the corresponding global symmetry also sort of realized as a sort of subsector. But of course, in meta models, there is lots of reasons to also have just pure global symmetries present. For instance, because certain global symmetries actually protect certain fields from decaying, which is, for instance, in the dark sector, sort of an important ingredient in order to guarantee stability of dark matter candidates and things like that.
Okay, thanks for replying to this anonymous question. I hope this replied to the person who asked that. Are there more questions from students? Or from anyone else? Benjamin.
Oh, yes, thank you, Astrid, for this really nice talk. I think I have one or two questions. So first, a quick one. If I saw correctly, the transverse mass scales with n squared, which sounded a bit not intuitive for me, because I would expect that if you have a very large n, the and maybe a small bump between the minima, that the mass should be small.
But I mean, the mass will be small because the larger you make n, the faster it's driven towards really tiny values.
Oh, okay.
So the n squared, I mean, it appears if you evaluate what the curvature of the potential is, but I mean, the mass will be smaller the larger you make n, because then the canonical scaling drives the coupling to zero even faster. So your intuition is exactly right. The larger you make n, the smaller the mass.
Okay, and kind of related to that, if you look at large n, so first of all, if you study the global structure of the potential, because if you have a very large n for the set n term, you get, of course, you at some point you overwhelm your classical phi to the 4 potential in some directions, and then potential would be unstable in certain directions.
It depends on the size of the coupling, right? So as long as the Zn coupling is small enough, you get these sort of small modulations of the potential. But for instance, in this case here, I mean, you still have the global stability.
I don't think that I understand it. Let's say I have a phi to the 4 potential plus a, let's say, n equal 10 modulation. At some point, mm-hmm. I should have unstable directions far out in field space, right?
I see what you mean. So we've not looked at sort of global stability at very large values of the field. So we have restricted ourselves to an analysis and around the origin where you do have local stability. And then the question whether you have global stability and whether you might have sort of tunneling, we've not looked at that.
Okay. Yeah. Sure. Thanks.
Are there more questions or comments? So I would have just a quick question. So do you have any argument why a non-minimal coupling between the gravity and the scalar field complex or real would not impact this the general result of that for n bigger than 4? One should not observe discrete symmetries at low energies.
Mm-hmm. If you look at the fixed point structure that you get if you include a non-minimal coupling as well in this setting, then generically that non-minimal coupling also has a fixed point at vanishing values, and therefore it doesn't impact the analysis here. If you would ask about the case where in some miraculous way you sort of generate a large fixed point value for the non-minimal coupling, I guess you could have modifications to the present setting, but in the studies that exist to date for the non-minimal coupling, you always get a vanishing fixed point value at that fixed point that we've explored, and so therefore it's just self-consistent to set it to zero here.
Mm-hmm. Are there more questions? Seems like there are no more questions, then I would suggest that everybody unmute themselves to thank Astrid again for this nice talk and discussion.